increasing ease. And now a team of civil and military engineers was pushing a road to the site, slashing a path across the tundra and through the trees, dropping tons of gravel on the path which might someday be properly paved, though such roads were a problem in these weather conditions. Over the roads would come heavy mining equipment and building materials for the workers who would soon make their homes in what had been his woods. They told him that the mine would be named in his honor. That hadn't been worth much more than a spit. And they'd taken most of his golden wolf pelts, after paying for them, and probably paying most generously, he allowed. The one thing they'd given him that he liked was a new rifle, an Austrian Steyr with a Zeiss scope in the American 338 Winchester Magnum caliber, more than ample for local game. The rifle was brand new. He'd fired only 15 rounds through it to make sure it was properly sighted in. The blued steel was immaculate, and the walnut stock was positively sensuous in its honeyed purity. How many Germans might he have killed with this, Gogol thought. And how many wolves and bear might he take now? They wanted him to leave his river and his woods. They promised him weeks on the beaches at Sochi, comfortable apartments anywhere in the country. Gogol snorted. Was he some city pansy? No, he was a man of the woods, a man of the mountains, a man feared by the wolves and the bear. And even the tigers to the south had probably heard of him. This land was his land. And truth be told, he knew no other way to live, and was too old to learn one in any case. What other men called comforts, he would call annoyances. And when his time came to die, he would be content to die in the woods and let a wolf or a bear pick over his corpse. It was only fair. He'd killed and skinned enough of them, after all. And good sport was good sport. Well, the food they'd brought in, flown in, they'd told him, was pretty good, especially the beef, which was richer than his usual reindeer, and he had fresh tobacco for his pipe. The television reporters loved the pipe, and encouraged him to tell his story of life in the Siberian forests, and his best bear and wolf stories. But he'd never see the TV story they were doing on him. He was too far away from what they occasionally called civilization to have his own TV set. Still, he was careful to tell his stories carefully and clearly, so that the children and grandchildren he'd never had would see what a great man he'd been. Like all men, Gogol had a proper sense of self-worth, and he would have made a fine storyteller for any children's school, which hadn't occurred to any of the bureaucrats and functionaries who'd come to disturb his existence. Rather, they saw him as a TV personality, and an example of the rugged individualist whom the Russians had always worshipped on the one hand and brutally suppressed on the other. But the real subject of the 40-minute story that was being put together by Russian national television wasn't really here. It was 17 kilometers away, where a geologist tossed a gold nugget the size of his fist up and down like a baseball, though it weighed far more than the equivalent volume of iron. That was merely the biggest nugget they'd found. This deposit, the geology team explained to the cameras, was worthy of a tale from mythology. The garden, perhaps, of Midas himself. Exactly how rich it was, they'd learn only from tunneling into the ground. But the chief of the geology team was willing to wager his professional reputation that it would beggar the South African mine, by far the richest found to date on the planet. Every day the tapes the cameras made were uploaded to the Russian communications satellite that spent most of its time hanging over the North Pole. Much of the country is too far north to make proper use of the geosynchronous birds used by the rest of the world. This was not a problem for the National Security Agency. NSA has stations worldwide, and the one located at Chicksands in England took the feed of the Russian satellite and instantly cross-loaded it to an American military communications satellite, which dispatched the signal to Fort Meade, Maryland. Agreeably, the signal was not encrypted, and so could be immediately forwarded to Russian linguists for translation. And then off it went to CIA and other national assets for evaluation. As it played out, the President of the United States would see the footage a week before the average Russian citizen. "Damn, who is that guy, Jim Bridger?" Jack asked. "His name is Pavel Petrovich Gogol. He's the guy credited with discovering the gold deposit." "See?" Ben Goodley said. The camera took in the row of gilded wolf pelts. "Damn, those could be hung in the Smithsonian. Like something out of a George Lucas movie," Swordsman observed. "Or you could buy one for your wife," Goodley suggested. POTUS shook his head. "Nah. But maybe if it was a gilded sable coat, you think the voters could handle it?" "I think I defer on such questions to Mr. Van Dam," the National Security Advisor said after a moment's consideration. "Yeah, might be fun to see him have a cow right here in the Oval Office." "This tape isn't classified, is it?" "Yes, it is, but only confidential." "Okay, I want to show this one to Kathy tonight." That level of classification wouldn't faze anybody, not even a major city newspaper. "You want one with subtitles or a voiceover translation?" "We both hate subtitles," Jack informed his aide with a look. "I'll have Langley get it done for you, then," Goodley promised. "She'll flip out when she sees that pelt." With the money from his investment portfolio, Ryan had become a connoisseur of fine jewelry and furs. For the former, he had an arrangement with Blickman's, a very special firm in Rockefeller Center. 2 weeks before the previous Christmas, one of their salespeople had come by train to Washington, accompanied by two armed guards, who hadn't been allowed into the White House proper. The outside guards had gone slightly nuts on learning that armed men were on campus, but Andrea Price O'Day had smoothed that over, and shown the president about $5 million worth of estate jewelry, and some pieces newly made just across the street from their office, some of which Ryan had purchased. His reward had been to see Kathy's eyes pop nearly out of her head under the Christmas tree, and lament the fact that all she'd gotten him was a nice set of Taylor golf clubs. But that was fine with Swordsman. To see his wife smile on Christmas morning was as fine a prize as he expected in life. Besides, it was proof that he had taste in jewelry, one of the better things for a man to have, at least in his woman's eyes. But damn, if he could have gotten her one of those wolf fur coats. Could he cut a deal with Sergei Golovko? Jack wondered briefly. But where the hell could you wear such a thing? He had to be practical. Would look nice in the closet, Goodley agreed, seeing the distant look in his boss's eyes. Color would go so nice with her butter blonde hair. Ryan mused on for a few more seconds, then shook his head to dismiss the thought. What else today? Sorga has developed new information. It's being couriered down even as we speak. Important? Mrs. Foley didn't say so, but you know how it works. Oh yeah, even the minor stuff fits together into a real pretty picture when you need it. The major download still sat in his private safe. The sad truth was that while he did technically have the time to read it, that would have entailed taking time away from his family. And it would have had to have been really important for the president to do that. So, what will the Americans do? Fang asked Zhang. On the trade issue? They will finally bow to the inevitable and grant us most favored nation status and remove their objection to our full entry into the World Trade Organization, the minister replied. None too soon, Fang Gan observed. That is true, Zhang Hansan agreed. The financial conditions in the PRC had been well concealed to this point, which was one advantage of the communist form of government, both ministers would have agreed, if they had ever considered another form of government. The cold truth of the matter was that the PRC was nearly out of foreign exchange, having spent it mainly on armaments and arms-related technology all over the world. Only incidental goods had come from America, mainly computer chips, which could be used in nearly any sort of mechanical contrivance. The overtly military material they'd purchased came most often from Western Europe, and sometimes from Israel. America sold what arms it released to this part of the world to the renegades on Taiwan, who paid cash, of course. That was like a mosquito bite to the mainland regime, not large, not life-threatening, but an annoyance that they continuously scratched at, in the process making it worse instead of better. There were over 1,000,000,000 people in mainland China, and less than 30 million on the island across the strait. The misnamed Republic of China used its people well, producing more than a quarter of the goods and services the PRC turned out in a given year with 40 times as many workers and peasants. However, while the mainland coveted the goods and services and the riches that resulted, they did not covet the political and economic system that made it possible. Their system was far superior, of course, because theirs was the better ideology. Mao himself had said so. Neither of these two Politburo members, nor any of the others, reflected much on the objective realities at hand. They were as certain in their beliefs as any Western clergyman was in his. They even ignored the self-evident fact that what prosperity the People's Republic possessed came from capitalist enterprise allowed by previous rulers, often over the screams and howls of other ministerial-rank politicians. The latter contented themselves by denying political influence to the people who were enriching their country, confident that this situation would go on forever, and that those businessmen and industrialists would be satisfied to make their money and live in relative luxury, while they, the political theorists, continued to manage the nation's affairs. After all, the weapons and the soldiers belonged to them, didn't they? And power still grew out of the barrel of a gun.
"You are certain of this?" Fang Gan asked.
"Yes, comrade, I am quite certain.
We have been good for the Yankees, haven't we? We have not rattled our saber at the Taiwanese bandits lately, have we?"
"What of American trade complaints?"
"Do they not understand business?" Zhang asked grandly. "We sell goods to them because of their quality and price. We shop the same way."
"Yes, I admit their Boeing airplane company makes fine airplanes, but so does Airbus in Europe. And the Europeans have been more accommodating to us politically. America rants on about opening our markets to their goods. And we do this. Slowly, of course. We need to keep the surplus they so kindly give us and spend it on items of importance to us. Next, we will expand our automobile production and enter their auto market, as the Japanese once did. In 5 years, Fang, we will be taking another $10 billion from America annually. And that, my friend, is a very conservative estimate."
"You think so?"
An emphatic nod.
"Yes. We will not make the mistake the Japanese made early on, selling ugly little cars. We are already looking for American styling engineers who will help us design automobiles which are aesthetically pleasing to the white devils."
"If you say so. When we have the money we need to build up our military, we will be the world's leading power in every respect. Industrially, we will lead the world. Militarily, we are at the center of the world."
"I fear these plans are too ambitious," Fang said cautiously. "They will take more years than we have to implement in any case. But what legacy will we leave to our country if we point her on an erroneous path?"
"What error is this, Fang?" Zhang asked. "Do you doubt our ideas?"
"Always that question," Fang thought with an inward sigh. "I remember when Deng said, 'It doesn't matter if the cat is black or white, so long as it catches mice.'
to which Mao responded with a livid snarl. What emperor said that?
But it does matter, my old friend, and well you know it.
That is true, Fang agreed with a submissive nod, not wanting a confrontation this late in the day. Not when he had a headache. Age had made Zhang even more ideologically pure than he'd been in his youth, and it hadn't tempered his imperial ambition. Fang sighed once more. He was of a mind to set the issue aside. It wasn't worth the trouble. Though he'd mention it just once more to cover his political backside.
What if they don't? Fang asked finally.
What?
What if they don't go along? What if the Americans are troublesome on the trade issue?
They will not be, Zhang assured his old friend.
But if they are, comrade, what then will we do? What are our options?
Oh, I suppose we could punish with one hand and encourage with the other, cancel some purchases from America, and then inquire about making some other ones.
It's worked before many times, Zhang assured his guest.
This President Ryan is predictable. We need merely control the news. We will give him nothing to use against us. Fang and Zhang continued their discussion into other issues, until the latter returned to his office, where again he dictated his notes of the discussion to Ming, who then typed them into her computer. The minister considered inviting her to his apartment, but decided against it. Though she'd become somewhat more attractive in the preceding weeks, catching his eye with her gentle smiles in the outer office, it had been a long day for him, and he was too tired for it. Enjoyable, though it often was with Ming. Minister Fang had no idea that his dictation would be in Washington, D.C. in less than 3 hours.
What do you think, George?
Jack, Trader began, what the hell is this? And how the hell did we get it?
George, this is an internal memorandum. Well, of sorts, from the government of the People's Republic of China. How we got it, you do not, repeat, not need to know.
The document had been laundered, scrubbed, better than mafia income. All the surnames had been changed, as had the syntax and adjectives, to disguise patterns of speech. It was thought, hoped would be a better term, that even those whose discourse was being reported would not have recognized their own words. But the content had been protected, even improved, in fact, since the nuances of Mandarin had been fully translated into American English idiom. That had been the hardest part. Languages do not really translate into one another easily or well. The denotations of words were one thing. The connotations were another. And these never really paralleled from one tongue to another. The linguists employed by the intelligence services were among the best in the country, people who regularly read poetry and sometimes published journal pieces under their own names, so that they could communicate their expertise in, and indeed love of, their chosen foreign language with others of a similar mind. What resulted were pretty good translations, Ryan thought. But he was always a little wary of them.
These cocksuckers! They're talking about how they plan to fuck us over.
For all his money, George Winston retained the patois of his working-class origins.
George, it's business, not personal, the president tried as a tension-release gambit.
The Secretary of the Treasury looked up from the briefing document.
Jack, when I ran Columbus Group, I had to regard all of my investors as my family, okay? Their money had to be as important to me as my money. That was my professional obligation as an investment counselor.
Jack nodded.
Okay, George, that's why I asked you into the cabinet. You're honest.
Okay, but now I'm sec-fucking-trez, okay? That means that every citizen in our country is part of my family, and these chink bastards are planning to fuck with my country. All those people out there.
Secretary Winston waved toward the thick windows of the Oval Office.
The ones who trust us to keep the economy leveled out.
So they want MFN, do they?
They want into the WTO, do they? Well, fuck them.
President Ryan allowed himself an early morning laugh, wondering if the Secret Service detail had heard George's voice, and might now be looking through the spy holes in the door to see what the commotion was. Coffee and croissants, George. The grape jelly is Smucker's, even. Trader stood and walked around the couch, tossing his head forcefully like a stallion circling a Marin heat. Okay, Jack, I'll cool down, but you're used to this shit, and I'm not. He paused and sat back down. Oh, okay, up on the street we trade jokes and stories, and we even plot a little bit, but deliberately fucking people over, no, I've never done that. And you know what's worst?
What's that, George?
They're stupid, Jack. They think they can mess with the marketplace according to their little political theories, and it'll fall into line like a bunch of soldiers right out of boot camp. These little bastards couldn't run a Kmart and show a profit. But they let them dick around with a whole national economy. And then they want to dick with ours, too.
Got it all out of your system?
Think this is funny? Winston asked crossly.
George, I've never seen you get this worked up. I'm surprised by your passion.
Who do you think I am, Jay Gould?
No, Ryan said judiciously. I was thinking more of J.P. Morgan.
The remark had the desired effect. Sectrez laughed.
Okay, you got me there.
Morgan was the first actual chairman of the Fed, and he did it as a private citizen, and did it pretty well. But that's probably an institutional function, 'cause there ain't that many J.P. Morgans waiting around on deck.
Okay, Mr. President, sir, I am calmed down. Yes, this is business, not personal. And our reply to this miserable business attitude will be business, too. The PRC will not get MFN. They will not get into the WTO. As a practical matter, they don't deserve it yet anyway, based on the size of their economy. And I think we rattle the Trade Reform Act at them nice and hard.
Oh, there's one other thing, and I'm surprised it's not in here, Winston said, pointing down at the briefing sheet.
What's that?
We can get 'em by the short hairs pretty easy, I think. CIA doesn't agree, but Mark Gant thinks their foreign exchange account's a little thin.
Oh? The president asked, stirring his coffee.
Winston nodded emphatically. Mark's my tech weenie, remember. He's very good at modeling stuff on the computers. I've set him up with his own little section to keep an eye on various things. Pulled a professor of economics out of Boston University to work there, Morton Silber, another good man with the microchips. Anyway, Mark's been looking at the PRC, and he thinks they're driving off the edge of the Grand Canyon because they've been pissing away their money, mainly on military hardware and heavy manufacturing equipment, like to make tanks and things. It's a repeat of the old communist stuff. They have a fixation on heavy industry. They are really missing the boat on electronics. They have little companies manufacturing computer games and stuff, but they're not applying it at home, except for that new computer factory they set up that's ripping off Dell.
So you think we ought to shove that up their ass at the trade negotiations?
I'm going to recommend it to Scott Adler at lunch this afternoon, as a matter of fact, Sectrez agreed. They've been warned, but this time we're going to press it hard.
Back to their foreign exchange account. How bad is it?
Mark thinks they're down to negative reserves.
In the hole? For how much? POTUS asked.
He says at least $15 billion, floated with paper out of German banks for the most part, but the Germans have kept it quiet, and we're not sure why. It could be a normal transaction, but either the Germans or the PRC wants to keep it under wraps.
Wouldn't be the Germans, would it? Ryan asked next.
Probably not. It makes their banks look good. And yeah, that leaves the Chinese covering it up.
Any way to confirm that?
I have some friends in Germany. I can ask around or have a friend do it for me. Better that way, I guess. Everybody knows I'm a government employee now, and that makes me sinister, Winston observed with a sly grin. Anyway, I'm having lunch with Scott today. What do I tell him about the trade negotiations?
Ryan thought about that for several seconds.
This was one of those moments,
the frightening ones as he thought of them, when his words would shape the policy of his own country, and possibly others as well. It was easy to be glib or flip, to say the first thing that popped into his mind, but no, he couldn't do that. Moments like this were too important, too vast in their potential consequences, and he couldn't allow himself to make government policy on a whim, could he? He had to think the matter through, quickly perhaps, but through. "We need China to know that we want the same access to their markets that we've given them to ours, and that we won't tolerate their stealing products from American companies without proper compensation. George, I want the playing field level and fair for everyone. If they don't want to play that way, we start hurting them." "Fair enough, Mr. President. I will pass that message along to your Secretary of State." "Want I should deliver this to?" Winston asked, holding up his Zorga briefing sheet. "No, Scott gets his own version of it. And George, be very, very careful with that. If the information leaks, a human being will lose his life," Swordsman told Trader, "deliberately disguising the source as a man, and therefore deliberately misleading his Secretary of the Treasury. But that, too, was business, and not personal. It goes into my confidential files." Which was a pretty secure place, they both knew. "Nice reading the other guy's mail, isn't it?" "Just about the best intelligence there is," Ryan agreed. "The guy's at Fort Meade, eh? Tapping into somebody's cell phone via satellite?" "Sources and methods. You really don't want to know that, George. There's always the chance that you'll spill it to the wrong person by mistake, and then you have some guy's life on your conscience. Something to be avoided, trust me." "I hear you, Jack. Well, I have a day to start. Thanks for the coffee and the pastry, boss." "Anytime, George. Later." Ryan turned to his appointment calendar as the secretary walked out the corridor door, from which he'd go downstairs, cross outside because the West Wing wasn't directly connected to the White House proper, dart back inside, and head off into the tunnel leading to Treasury. Outside Ryan's office, the Secret Service detail went over the appointment list also. But their copy also included the results of a National Crime Information computer check, to make sure that no convicted murderer was being admitted into the sanctum sanctorum of the United States of America. Chapter 17. The Coinage of Gold. Scott Adler was regarded as too young and inexperienced for the job, but that judgment came from would-be political appointees who'd schemed their way to near the top, whereas Adler had been a career Foreign Service officer since his graduation from Tufts University's Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy 26 years earlier. Those who'd seen him work regarded him as a very astute diplomatic technician. Those who played cards with him — Adler liked to play poker before a major meeting or negotiation — thought he was one very lucky son of a bitch. His seventh-floor office at the State Department building was capacious and comfortable. Behind his desk was a credenza covered with the usual framed photographs of spouse, children, and parents. He didn't like wearing his suit jacket at his desk, as he found it too confining for comfort. In this, he'd outraged some of the senior State Department bureaucrats, who thought this an entirely inappropriate informality. He did, of course, don the jacket for important meetings with foreign dignitaries, but he didn't think internal meetings were important enough to be uncomfortable for. That suited George Winston, who tossed his coat over a chair when he came in. Like himself, Scott Adler was a working guy, and those were the people with whom Winston was most comfortable. He might be a career government puke, but the son of a bitch had a work ethic, which was more than he could say for too many of the people in his own department. He was doing his best to weed the drones out, but it was no easy task, and civil service rules made firing unproductive people a non-trivial exercise. "Have you read the Chinese stuff?" Adler asked, as soon as the lunch tray was on the table. "Yeah, Scott. I mean, holy shit, fella," Trader observed to Eagle. Welcome to the club. The intelligence stuff we get can be very interesting. The State Department had its own spook service called Intelligence and Research, or I&R, which, while it didn't exactly compete with CIA and the other services, occasionally turned up its own rough little diamonds from the thick diplomatic mud. So, what do you think of our little yellow brothers? Winston managed not to growl. Buddy, I might not even eat their goddamn food anymore. They make our worst robber barons look like Mother Teresa. They're conscienceless motherfuckers, George, and that's a fact. Winston immediately started liking Adler more. A guy who talked like this had real possibilities. Now it was his turn to be coldly professional to counterpoint Adler's working-class patois. They're ideologically driven, then? Totally. Well, maybe with a little corruption thrown in. But remember, they figure that their political astuteness entitles them to live high on the hog, and so to them it's not corruption at all. They just collect tributes from the peasants, and peasant is a word they still use over there. In other words, we're dealing with dukes and earls? The Secretary of State nodded. Essentially, yes. They have an enormous sense of personal entitlement. They are not used to hearing the word no in any form, and as a result they don't always know what to do when they do hear it from people like me. That's why they're often at a disadvantage in negotiations, at least when we play hardball with them. We haven't done much of that, but last year, after the Airbus shoot-down, I came on a little strong, and then we followed up with official diplomatic recognition of the ROC government on Taiwan. That really put the PRC noses seriously out of joint, even though the ROC government hasn't officially declared its independence.
What?
Somehow Sec-Trez had missed that.
Yeah, the people on Taiwan play a pretty steady and reasonable game. They've never really gone out of their way to offend the mainland. Even though they have embassies all over the world, they've never actually proclaimed the fact that they're an independent nation. That would flip the Beijing Chinese out. Maybe the guys in Taipei think it would be bad manners or something. At the same time, we have an understanding that Beijing knows about. If somebody messes with Taiwan, Seventh Fleet comes over to keep an eye on things, and we will not permit a direct military threat to the Republic of China government. The PRC doesn't have enough of a navy to worry our guys that much, and so all that flies back and forth really is words.
Adler looked up from his sandwich. Sticks and stones, you know. Well, I had breakfast with Jack this morning, and we talked about the trade talks.
And Jack wants to play a little rougher?
Sec-State asked.
It wasn't much of a surprise. Ryan had always preferred fair play, and that was often a rare commodity in the intercourse among nation-states.
You got it, Winston confirmed around a bite of his sandwich. One thing about working-class people like Adler, the Sec-Trez thought, they knew what a proper lunch was. He was so tired of fairy-fied French food for lunch. Lunch was supposed to be a piece of meat with bread wrapped around it. French cuisine was just fine, but for dinner, not for lunch.
How rough?
We get what we want. We need them to get accustomed to the idea that they need us a hell of a lot more than we need them.
That's a tall order, George.
If they don't want to listen,
knock louder on the door, or on their heads. Scott, you read the same document this morning I did, right?
Yeah, Sec-State confirmed.
The people they're cheating out of their jobs are American citizens.
I know that. But what you have to remember is that we can't dictate to a sovereign country. The world doesn't work that way.
Okay, fine, but we can tell them that they can't dictate trade practices to us either.
George, for a long time, America has taken a very soft line on these issues.
Maybe, but the Trade Reform Act is now law.
Yeah, I remember.
I also remember how it got us into a shooting war, Adler reminded his guest.
We won. I remember that, too.
Maybe other people will as well.
Scott, we're running a huge trade deficit with the Chinese. The President says that has to stop.
I happen to agree.
If we can buy from them, then they damned well have to buy from us, or we buy our chopsticks and teddy bears elsewhere.
There are jobs involved, Adler warned. They know how to play that card. They cancel contracts and stop buying our finished goods, and then some of our people lose their jobs, too.
Or if we succeed, then we sell more finished goods to them, and our factories have to hire people to make them.
Play to win, Scott, Winston advised.
I always do, but this isn't a baseball game with rules and fences. It's like racing a sailboat in the fog. You can't always see your adversary, and you can damn near never see the finish line.
I can buy you some radar, then. How about I give you one of my people to help out?
Who?
Mark Gant. He's my computer whiz. He really knows the issues from a technical monetary point of view.
Adler thought about that. State Department had always been weak in that area. Not too many business-savvy people ended up in the Foreign Service, and learning it from books wasn't the same as living it out in the real world, a fact that too many State Department professionals didn't always appreciate as fully as they should.
Okay, send him over. Now, just how rough are we supposed to play this?
Well, I guess you'll need to talk that one over with Jack, but from what he told me this morning, we want the playing field leveled out.
An easy thing to say, Adler thought, but less easy to accomplish. He liked and admired President Ryan, but he wasn't blind to the fact that Swordsman was not the most patient guy in the world. And in diplomacy, patience was everything. Hell, patience was just about the only thing.
Okay, he said after a moment's reflection. I'll talk it over with him before I tell my people what to say. This could get nasty. The Chinese play rough.
Life's a bitch, Scott, Winston advised.
Sextate smiled.
Okay, duly noted.
Let me see what Jack says.
So how's the market doing?
Still pretty healthy. Price-earnings ratios are still a little outrageous, but profits are generally up, inflation is under control, and the investment community is nice and comfy. The Fed chairman is keeping a nice, even strain on monetary policy. We're going to get the changes we want in the tax code, so things look pretty good. It's always easier to steer the ship in calm seas, you know.
Adler grimaced.
Yeah, I'll have to try that sometime.
But he had marching orders to lay on a typhoon. This would get interesting.
So, how's readiness? General Diggs asked his assembled officers.
Could be better, the colonel commanding 1st Brigade admitted. We've been short lately on funds for training. We have the hardware, and we have the soldiers, and we spend a lot of time in the simulators. But that's not the same as going out in the dirt with our tracks.
There was general nodding on that point.
"It's a problem for me, sir," said Lieutenant Colonel Angelo Giusti, who commanded 1st Squadron, 4th Armored Cavalry Regiment. Known within the Army as the quarter horse for the 1st 4th Unit Designator, it was the Division Reconnaissance Screen, and its commander reported directly to the commanding general of 1st Tanks instead of through a brigade commander.
"I can't get my people out, and it's hard to train for reconnaissance in the caserne. The local farmers get kinda irate when we crunch through their fields, and so we have to pretend we can do recon from hard surface roads. Well, sir, we can't, and that bothers me some."
There was no denying the fact that driving armored vehicles across a cornfield was tough on the corn. And while the U.S. Army trailed every tactical formation with a Hummer, whose passengers came with a big checkbook to pay for the damage, the Germans were a tidy people. And Yankee dollars didn't always compensate for the suddenly untidy field. It had been easier when the Red Army had been right on the other side of the fence, threatening death and destruction on West Germany. But Germany was now one sovereign country, and the Russians were now on the far side of Poland, and a lot less threatening than they'd once been. There were a few places where large formations could exercise, but those were as fully booked as the prettiest debutante's dance card at the cotillion. And so the quarter horse spent too much time in simulators, too.
"Okay," Dig said.
The good news is that we are going to profit from the new federal budget. We have lots more funds to train with, and we can start using them in 12 days. Colonel Masterman, do you have some ways for us to spend it?
Well, General, I think I might come up with something. Can we pretend that it's 1983 again?
At the height of the Cold War, 7th Army had trained to as fine an edge as any army in history, a fact ultimately demonstrated in Iraq rather than in Germany, but with spectacular effect. 1983 had been the year the increased funding had first taken real effect, a fact noted fully by the KGB and GRU intelligence officers, who'd thought until that time that the Red Army might have had a chance to defeat NATO. By 1984, even the most optimistic Russian officers fell off that bandwagon for all time. If they could reestablish that training regimen, the assembled officers all knew they'd have a bunch of happy soldiers, because, though training is hard work, it is what the troops had signed up for. A soldier in the field is most often a happy soldier.
Colonel Masterman, the answer to your question is yes. Back to my original question. How's readiness?
We're at about 85%, 2nd Brigade estimated. Probably 90 or so for the artillery.
Thank you, Colonel, and I agree, the Colonel commanding Divisional Artillery interjected.
But we all know how easy life is for the cannon cockers, 2nd Brigade added as a barb.
Aviation? Diggs asked next.
Sir, my people are within 3 weeks of being at 100%. Fortunately, we don't squash anybody's corn when we're up practicing. My only complaint is that it's too easy for my people to track tanks on the ground if they're roadbound. And a little more realistic practice wouldn't hurt. But, sir, I'll put my aviators up against anyone in this man's army, especially my Apache drivers.
The snake drivers enjoyed a diet of raw meat and human babies. The problems they'd had in Yugoslavia a few years earlier had alarmed a lot of people, and the aviation community had cleaned up its act with alacrity.
Okay, so you're all in pretty good shape, but you won't mind sharpening the edge up a little, eh? Diggs asked, and got the nods he expected.
He'd read up on all his senior officers on the flight across the pond. There was little in the way of dead wood here. The Army had less trouble than the other services in holding on to good people. The airlines didn't try to hire tank commanders away from 1st Armored, though they were always trying to steal fighter and other pilots from the Air Force. And while police forces love to hire experienced infantrymen, his division had only about 1,500 of them, which was the one structural weakness in an armored division. Not enough people with rifles and bayonets. An American tank division was superbly organized to take ground, to immolate everyone who happened to be on real estate they wanted, but not so well equipped to hold the ground they overran. The United States Army had never been an army of conquest. Indeed, its ethos had always been liberation, and part and parcel of that was the expectation that the people who lived there would be of assistance, or at least show gratitude for their deliverance, rather than hostility. It was so much a part of the American military's history that its senior members rarely, if ever, thought about other possibilities. Vietnam was too far in the past now. Even Diggs had been too young for that conflict, and though he'd been told how lucky he was to have missed it, it was something he almost never thought about. Vietnam had not been his war, and he didn't really want to know about light infantry in the jungle. He was a cavalryman, and his idea of combat was tanks and Bradleys on open ground.
Okay, gentlemen, I'll want to meet with all of you individually in the next few days. Then I need to come out and see your outfits. You will find that I'm a fairly easy guy to work for. By which he meant that he wasn't a screamer, as some general officers were. He demanded excellence as much as anyone else, but he didn't think ripping a man's head off in public was a good way to achieve it. And I know you're all pretty good. In 6 months or less, I want this division ready to deal with anything that might come down the road. I mean anything at all.
Who might that be? Colonel Masterman mused to himself. The Germans?
It might be a little harder to motivate the troops, given the total absence of a credible threat. But the sheer joy of soldiering was not all that much different from the kick associated with football. For the right guy, it was just plain fun to play in the mud with the big toys. And after a while, they started wondering what the real thing might be like. There was a leavening of troops in 1st Tanks from the 10th and 11th Cavalry Regiments who'd fought the previous year in Saudi Arabia. And like all soldiers, they told their stories. But few of the stories were unhappy ones. Mainly, they expounded on how much like training it had been, and referred to their then-enemies as poor, dumb, raghead sons of bitches, who'd been, in the final analysis, unworthy of their steel. But that just made them swagger a little more. A winning war leaves only good memories for the most part, especially a short winning war. Drinks would be hoisted, and the names of the lost would be invoked with sadness and respect. But the overall experience had not been a bad one for the soldiers involved. It wasn't so much that soldiers lusted for combat, just that they often felt like football players who practiced hard but never actually got to play for points. Intellectually, they knew that combat was the game of death, not football, but that was too theoretical for most of them. The tankers fired their practice rounds, and if the pop-up targets were steel, there was the satisfaction of seeing sparks from the impact. But it wasn't quite the same as seeing the turret pop off the target atop a column of flame and smoke, and knowing that the lives of 3 or 4 people had been extinguished like a birthday cake candle in front of a 5-year-old. The veterans of the 2nd Persian Gulf War did occasionally talk about what it was like to see the results of their handiwork, usually with a, "Jesus, it was really something awful to see, bro." But that was as far as it went. For soldiers, killing wasn't really murder once you stepped back from it. They'd been the enemy, and both had played the game of death on the same playing field, and one side had won, and the other side had lost. And if you weren't willing to run that risk, well, don't put the uniform on, you know. Or, train better, asshole, 'cause we be serious out here. And that was the other reason soldiers liked to train. It wasn't just interesting and fairly enjoyable hard work. It was life insurance if the game ever started for real, and soldiers, like gamblers, liked to hold good cards. Diggs adjourned the meeting, waving for Colonel Masterman to stay behind.
"Well, Duke?" "I've been nosing around. What I've seen is pretty good, sir. Giusti is especially good, and he's always bitching about training time. I like that."
"So do I," Diggs agreed at once.
"What else?"
"Like the man said, artillery is in very good shape, and your maneuver brigades are doing okay, considering the lack of field time. They might not like using the sims all that much, but they are making good use of them. They're about 20% off where we were in the 10th Cav down in the Negev playing with the Israelis, and that isn't bad at all. Sir, you give me 3 or 4 months in the field, and they'll be ready to take on the world."
"Well, Duke, I'll write you the check next week. Got your plans ready?"
"Day after tomorrow. I'm taking some helicopter rides to scout out the ground we can use and what we can't. There's a German brigade says they're eager to play aggressor for us."
"They any good?"
"They claim to be.
I guess we'll just have to see.
I recommend we send 2nd Brigade out first. They're a little sharper than the other two. Colonel Lyle is our kind of colonel.
His package looks pretty good.
He'll get his star next go-around."
"About right," Masterman agreed.
"And what about my star?" he couldn't ask.
He figured himself a pretty good bet, but you never really knew. Oh, well, at least he was working for a fellow cavalryman.
"Okay, show me your plans for 2nd Brigade's next adventure in the farmland. Tomorrow?"
"The broad strokes, yes, sir."
Masterman bobbed his head and walked off toward his office.
"How rough?" Cliff Rutledge asked.
"Well," Adler replied, "I just got off the phone with the president, and he says he wants what he wants, and it's our job to get it for him."
"Well, that's a mistake, Scott," the Assistant Secretary of State warned.
"Mistake or not, we work for the president."
"I suppose so, but Beijing's been pretty good about not tearing us a new asshole over Taiwan.
This might not be the right time for us to press on them so hard.
Even as we speak, American jobs are being lost because of their trade policy, Adler pointed out. When does enough become too much?
I guess Ryan decides that, eh?
That's what the Constitution says.
And you want me to meet with them, then?
Sextate nodded.
Correct. 4 days from now.
Put your position paper together and run it past me before we deliver it. But I want them to know we're not kidding. The trade deficit has to come down, and it has to come down soon. They can't make that much money off us and spend it somewhere else.
But they can't buy military hardware from us, Rutledge observed.
What do they need all that hardware for? Scott Adler asked rhetorically. What external enemies do they have?
They'll say that their national security is their affair.
And we reply that our economic security is our affair, and they're not helping. That meant observing to the PRC that it looked as though they were preparing to fight a war. But against whom? And was that a good thing for the world? Rutledge would ask with studied sang-froid.
Rutledge stood.
Okay, I can present our case. I'm not fully comfortable with it, but... Well, I suppose I don't have to be, do I?
Also correct.
Adler didn't really like Rutledge all that much. His background and advancement had been more political than properly earned. He'd been very tight with former Vice President Keelty, for example, but after that incident had settled out, Cliff had dusted off his coattails with admirable speed. He would probably not get another promotion. He'd gone as far as one could go without really serious political ties, say a teaching position at the Kennedy School at Harvard, where one taught and became a talking head on the PBS Evening News Hour and waited to be noticed by the right political hopeful. But that was pure luck. Rutledge had come farther than actual merit could justify. But with it came a comfortable salary and a lot of prestige on the Washington cocktail party circuit, where he was on most of the A-lists. And that meant that when he left government service, he'd increase his income by an order of magnitude or so with some consulting firm or other. Adler knew he could do the same, but probably wouldn't. He'd probably take over the Fletcher School at Tufts and try to pass along what he'd learned to a new generation of would-be diplomats. He was too young for real retirement, though there was little in the way of a government afterlife from being Secretary of State, and academia wouldn't be too bad. Besides, he'd get to do the odd consulting job, and do op-ed pieces for the newspapers, where he would assume the role of elder statesman sage.
Okay, let me get to work.
Rutledge walked out and turned left to head to his seventh-floor office.
Well, this was a plum, the assistant secretary thought, even if it was the wrong plum.
The Ryan guy was not what he thought a president should be. He thought international discourse was about pointing guns at people's heads and making demands, instead of reasoning with them. Rutledge's way took longer, but was a lot safer. You had to give something to get something. Well, sure, there wasn't much left to give the PRC, except maybe renouncing America's diplomatic recognition of Taiwan. It wasn't hard to understand the reason they'd done it, but it had still been a mistake. It made the PRC unhappy, and you couldn't let some damned fool principle get in the way of international reality. Diplomacy, like politics, another area in which Ryan was sadly lacking, was a practical business. There were 1 billion people in the People's Republic, and you had to respect that. Sure, Taiwan had a democratically elected government and all that, but it was still a breakaway province of China, and that made it an internal matter. Their civil war was a 50-plus-year affair, but Asia was a place where people took the long-term view.
He thought, sitting down at his desk. We want what we want, and we're going to get what we want.
Rutledge took out a legal pad and leaned back in his chair to make some notes. It might be the wrong policy. It might be dumb policy. It might be policy he disagreed with. But it was policy. And if he ever wanted to be kicked upstairs, actually to a different office on the same floor, to Under Secretary of State,
He had to present the policy as though it were his own personal passion. It was like being a lawyer, Rutledge thought. They had to argue dumb cases all the time, didn't they? That didn't make them mercenaries. It made them professionals. And he was a professional. And besides, he'd never been caught. One thing about Ed Keelty, he'd never told anybody how Rutledge had tried to help him be president. Duplicitous he might have been toward the president, but he'd been loyal to his own people about it, as a politician was supposed to be. And that Ryan guy, smart as he might have been, he'd never caught on. So there, Mr. President, Rutledge thought. You may be smart, you think, but you need me to formulate your policy for you. Ha!
This is a pleasant change, Comrade Minister, Bondarenko observed on coming in.
Golovko waved him to a chair and poured him a small glass of vodka, the fuel of a Russian business meeting. The visiting General Lieutenant took the obligatory sip and expressed his thanks for the formal hospitality. He most often came here after normal working hours, but this time he'd been summoned officially, and right after lunch. It would have made him uneasy. Once upon a time, such an invitation to KGB headquarters would involve a quick trip to the men's room, except for his cordial relationship with Russia's chief spy.
Well, Gennady Yosifovich, I've talked you and your ideas over with President Grushevoy, and you've had 3 stars for a long time. It is time, the President and I agreed, for you to have another. And a new assignment.
Indeed?
Bondarenko wasn't taken aback, but he became instantly wary. It wasn't always pleasant to have one's career in others' hands, even others one liked.
Yes. As of Monday next, you will be General Colonel Bondarenko, and soon after that you will travel to become Commander-in-Chief of the Far East Military District.
That got his eyebrows jolting upward. This was the award of a dream he'd held in his own mind for some time.
Oh? May I ask, why there?
I happen to agree with your concerns regarding our yellow neighbors. I've seen some reports from the GRU about the Chinese Army's continuing field exercises. And, to be truthful, our intelligence information from Beijing is not all we would wish. Therefore, Eduard Petrovich and I feel that our eastern defenses might need some firming up.
That becomes your job, Gennady. Do it well, and some additional good things might happen for you.
And that could only mean one thing, Bondarenko thought, behind an admirable poker face. Beyond the 4 stars of a general colonel lay only the single large star of a marshal, and that was as high as any Russian soldier could go. After that, one could be commander-in-chief of the entire army, or defense minister, or one could retire to write memoirs.
There are some people I'd like to take out to Chebarsavir with me, some colonels from my operations office, the general said contemplatively.
That is your prerogative, of course. Tell me, what will you wish to do out there?
Do you really want to know? The newly frocked 4-star asked.
Golovko smiled broadly at that.
I see. Gennady, you wish to remake the Russian army in your image?
Not my image, Comrade Minister. A winning image, such as we had in 1945. There are images one wishes to deface, and there are images one dares not touch. Which, do you think, ought we to have?
What will the costs be?
Sergei Nikolaevich, I am not an economist, nor am I an accountant. But I can tell you that the cost of doing this will be far less than the cost of not doing it.
And now, Bondarenko thought, he'd get wider access to whatever intelligence his country possessed. It'd have been better if Russia had spent the same resources on what the Americans delicately called national technical means, strategic reconnaissance satellites, that the Soviet Union had once done. But he'd get such as there was, and maybe he could talk the Air Force into making a few special flights.
I will tell that to President Grushevoy.
Not that it would do all that much good. The cupboard was still bare of funding, though that could change in a few years.
Will these new mineral discoveries in Siberia give us a little more money to spend?
Golovko nodded. Yes, but not for some years. Patience, Gennady. The general took a final shot of the vodka.
I can be patient, but will the Chinese?
Golovko had to grant his visitor's concern.
Yes, they are exercising their military forces more than they used to.
What had once been a cause for concern had become, with its continuance, a matter of routine. And Golovko, like many, tended to lose such information in the seemingly random noise of daily life. But there are no diplomatic reasons for concern. Relations between our countries are cordial.
Comrade Minister, I am not a diplomat. Nor am I an intelligence officer, but I do study history. I recall that the Soviet Union's relations with Hitler's Germany were cordial right up until June 23, 1941. The leading German elements passed Soviet trains running westbound with oil and grain to the fascisti. I conclude from this that diplomatic discourse is not always an indicator of a nation's intentions.
That is true, and that is why we have an intelligence service.
And then you will also recall that the People's Republic has in the past looked with envy on the mineral riches of Siberia. That envy has probably grown with the discoveries we have made. We have not publicized them, but we may assume that the Chinese have intelligence sources right here in Moscow, yes?
It is a possibility not to be discounted, Golovko admitted. He didn't add that those sources would most probably be true-believing communists from Russia's past, people who lamented the fall of their nation's previous political system, and saw in China the means, perhaps, to restore Russia to the true faith of Marxism-Leninism, albeit with a little Mao tossed in. Both men had been Communist Party members in their day. Bondarenko, because advancement in the Soviet army had absolutely demanded it. And Golovko, because he would never have been entrusted with a post in KGB without it. Both had mouthed the words and kept their eyes mostly open during party meetings, in both cases while checking out the women in the meetings or just daydreaming about things of more immediate interest. But there were those who had listened and thought about it, who had actually believed all that political rubbish. Both Bondarenko and Golovko were pragmatists, interested mainly in a reality they could touch and feel rather than some model of words that might or might not come to pass some day. Fortunately for both, they'd found their way into professions more concerned with reality than theory, where their intellectual explorations were more easily tolerated. Because men of vision were always needed, even in a nation where vision was supposed to be controlled.
But you will have ample assets to act upon your concerns.
Not really, the general thought. He'd have, what, 6 motor rifle divisions, a tank division, and a divisional formation of artillery, all regular army formations at about 70% nominal strength and dubious training. That would be his first task, and not a minor one, to crack those uniformed boys into Red Army soldiers of the sort who had crushed the Germans at Kursk and moved on to capture Berlin.
That would be a major feat to accomplish. But who was better suited to this task? Bondarenko asked himself.
There were some promising young generals he knew of, and maybe he'd steal one. But for his own age group, Gennady Yosifovich Bondarenko felt himself to be the best brain in his nation's armed forces. Well, then, he'd have an active command and a chance to prove it. The chance of failure was always there, but men such as he are the kind who see opportunities where others see dangers.
"I presume I will have a free hand," he asked, after some final contemplation.
"Within reason," Golovko nodded.
"We'd prefer that you did not start a war out there. I have no desire to drive to Beijing. I have never enjoyed their cooking," Bondarenko replied lightly.
"And Russians should be better soldiers. The fighting ability of the Russian male had never been an issue for doubt. He just needed good training, good equipment, and proper leadership." Bondarenko thought he could supply 2 of those needs, and that would have to do.
Already his mind was racing east, thinking about his headquarters, what sort of staff officer he would find, whom he'd have to replace, and where the replacements would come from. There'd be drones out there, careerist officers just serving their time and filling out their forms, as if that were what it meant to be a field-grade officer. Those men would see their careers aborted. Well, he'd give everyone 30 days to straighten up, and if he knew himself, he'd inspire some to rediscover their vocations. His best hope was in the individual soldiers, the young boys wearing their country's uniform indifferently because no one had told them exactly what they were and how important that thing was. But he'd fix that. They were soldiers, those boys. Guardians of their country, and they deserve to be proud guardians. With proper training, in 9 months they'd wear the uniforms better, stand straighter, and swagger a bit on leave, as soldiers were supposed to do. He'd show them how to do it, and he'd become their surrogate father, pushing and cajoling his new crop of sons toward manhood. It was as worthy a goal as any man could wish, and as Commander-in-Chief Far East, he just might set a standard for his country's armed forces to emulate.
"So, Gennady Yosifovich, what do I tell Edvard Petrovich?" Golovko asked,
as he leaned across the desk to give his guest a little more of the fine Starka vodka. Bondarenko lifted the glass to salute his host.
"Comrade Minister, you will please tell our President that he has a new sink far east."
Chapter 18 Evolutions. The interesting part for Mancuso in his new job was that he now commanded aircraft, which he could fairly well understand, but also ground troops, which he hardly understood at all. This latter contingent included the 3rd Marine Division based on Okinawa, and the Army's 25th Light Infantry Division at Schofield Barracks on Oahu. Mancuso had never directly commanded more than 150 or so men, all of whom had been aboard his first and last real, as he thought of it, command, USS Dallas. That was a good number, large enough that it felt larger than even an extended family, and small enough that you knew every face and name. Pacific Command wasn't anything like that. The square of Dallas's crew didn't begin to comprise the manpower which he could direct from his desk. He'd been through the capstone course. That was a program designed to introduce new flag officers to the other branches of the service. He'd walked in the woods with Army soldiers, crawled in the mud with Marines, even watched an aerial refueling from the jump seat of a C-5B transport. The most unnatural act he ever expected to see, two airplanes mating in midair at 300 knots. And played with the Army's heavy troops at Fort Irwin, California, where he'd tried his hand at driving and shooting tanks and Bradleys. But seeing it all and playing with the kids and getting mud on his clothing wasn't really the same as knowing it. He had some very rough ideas of what it looked and sounded and smelled like. He'd seen the confident look on the faces of men who wore uniforms of different color, and told himself about 100 times that they were really all the same. The sergeant commanding an Abrams tank was little different in spirit from a leading torpedoman on a fast attack boat, just not recently showered, and a green beret was little different from a fighter pilot in his godlike self-confidence. But to command such people effectively, he ought to know more, Sink Pack told himself. He ought to have had more joint training. But then he told himself that he could take the best fighter jock in the Air Force or the Navy, and even then it would take months for them to understand what he'd done on Dallas. Hell, just getting them to understand the importance of reactor safety would take a year. About what it had taken him to learn all those things once upon a time. And Mancuso wasn't a nuke by training. He'd always been a front-end guy. The services were all different in their feel for the mission, and that was because the missions were all as different in nature as a sheepdog was from a pit bull. But he had to command them all, and do so effectively, lest he make a mistake that resulted in a telegram coming to Mrs. Smith's home to announce the untimely death of her son or